With the first matter on today's argument calendar, United States v. Rhodes, 21-2236. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Moore and I represent the defendant appellant, Jason Rhodes. Disgorgement of ill-gotten gains, that is the target of forfeiture. The ill-gotten gains in this case are approximately $400,000. $400,000. Now, the forfeiture order here was for $25,400,000. It's a $25 million increase. Now, this is plain error.
And the $400,000, that's the money that you're saying went into your client's pocket, right?
Yes.
But there is lots of money that went to pay other customers of Sentinel, right?
Yes.
And that went to investments that didn't pan out or other things like that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't that money that he had control over and that he was an officer of Sentinel? Right?
Well, it depends on the account. So we have the Bank of America account, which is Sentinel. That is completely dominated and controlled by Verace. The government did not introduce a single shred of evidence that Rhodes ever touched that account, even had access to it.
But there was another account.
There was the Whedon account, Your Honor. That's the prime brokerage account. Now, in order...
Is that not the account from which most of the client funds were misappropriated?
No,
allegedly.
The account from which the client funds were misappropriated was the Bank of America account. So in practice, what happened, there were three ways that Verace could steal funds. The first way was you have investor funds deposited into Bank of America. You don't put those funds at all into Wheaton, or you only put a portion of them. Now, as to those funds, because Rhodes never had control of the Bank of America account, they shouldn't count against Rhodes for forfeiture purposes. So that's the first method. The second method is funds are deposited into Bank of America. They are then sent by Verace to Wheaton. Rhodes is the sole signatory on the Wheaton account. Verace submits redemption requests to the Whedon account bearing Rhodes' name.
So the funds went from the Bank of America account to the Whedon account?
Yes.
Okay. And how much are we talking about?
Well, on the government's estimate, we have, I think it's roughly $25 million or a little bit there under.
So that's where the number comes from?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So at some point, everything for our purposes, the relevant amount, goes through from the Bank of America account to the Wheaton account. Is that right?
Well, how the government calculated the amount is really complicated.
I appreciate it, but that's why I started off with roughly.
No, I understand Your Honor's point. Base 8005B in the record, that's the most important exhibit here. So it is unclear to me, just based on that exhibit, if the government actually...
Wait, what page is that? Is that 499? I've got 499 and 500, but maybe that's not what you're talking about.
It's on A505.
505, okay.
And I apologize, A503. Right, there's so many. Let's look at A504.
So if you look at A504, what happens here is the government has calculated the deposits into Bank of America. All right. Now, we don't have a methodology here for what money went into Whedon and then was sent back. That's the second method of Verace's misappropriation. Or the money that just went into Bank of America and never made its way to Wheaton. So if the government's hook here is Rhodes' alleged control over the Wheaton account, that in and of itself would not account for the funds that were in Bank of America and never made it to Wheaton.
Account, because that's the way that they accounted for client funds, all transfers out went through the Wheaton account?
No, Your Honor. Sometimes Verace would not send the full amount into Wheaton.
But you said the $25 million eventually, but there's obviously a dispute, but for now we've got a record, eventually went from the Bank of America account to the Wheaton account. Is that correct?
I do not know, Your Honor. It's not clear on this record. What we have here, the government's calculation is you have deposits into Bank of America.
Let me ask you this way. Is there something in the record that shows that Huarache made a disbursement from the Bank of America account where the money never traveled through the Wheaton account?
Yes, there are. The government introduced into evidence the bank statements. So on remand, we could calculate that amount.
Okay.
Okay. So that was the first method.
Can I clarify? I'm sorry. One thing. Just sure. On this 504.
Yes.
When you're saying you don't know, I mean, this shows more than 20 million direct deposits into Wheaton. Doesn't that get you well above the forfeiture amount?
Which column are you looking at, Your Honor? I apologize.
The very first column. It's at the top. It says direct deposits into Wheaton.
No, Your Honor. This is the direct deposits into Wheaton. This Saroff amount, that's not part of this case. I don't think the government...
Well, the Saroff isn't, but the Flatiron is, and that's $6.1 million there, right? Am I misunderstanding that?
Yes, that's $6.1 million. So
and that clearly went through the Wheaton account.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's already getting us pretty close to our forfeiture amount.
No, that's $6 million. Forfeiture was $25,400,000.
Got it.
So that the first method is funds never even went into Wheaton. The second method is funds went into Wheaton and then a redemption request was submitted by Huarache bearing Rhodes' signature.
So at the top before, this is the question. Yeah. So we've got United States v. Contravenes.
Yes.
We've got some other summary orders, at least one, that suggests that if, at least in this case, a defendant is the sole signatory of an account, and funds go through that account, then that the funds are under his or her control. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. It's not just the fact that somebody is a sole signatory. You have to show control and domination. Control and domination.
So if I'm the sole signatory of my account, and it can't be no funds can be dispersed from that account without my signature, why isn't that a sufficient level of control?
I understand, Your Honor.
I mean, there's not a gun to my head. There's just I either sign or I do not. And how do you then distinguish what we said in Contravenes and the whole line of cases prior to Contravenes, where we said just having control over an account is enough for purposes of determining the forfeited amount or forfeitable amount?
I understand, Your Honor. It's a great question, and I want to address it right now. In terms of being the sole signatory, I understand. Funds could not have been dispersed from Wheaton but for Jason Rhodes, his knowledge. Now, when you look at the reality of these facts, what really happened here, Huarache would submit the request to the prime broker. Sometimes he forged Jason Rhodes' signature. Sometimes Jason Rhodes was CC'd on an email. Sometimes when Huarache forged Jason Rhodes would get a call from the prime broker verifying this amount. Huarache is the driving force here.
Wasn't this all the subject of a fatical hearing?
It was, Your
Honor.
And
wasn't the district court judge, unlike the three of us there, to observe the testimony and to have a better understanding of the nuanced factual evidence that you're now reciting to us? In other words, I think the standard of review is this some sort of an abuse of discretion? Tell me why we should replace our own view, or your view, frankly, of the evidence with the district court judges.
Because fundamentally here, we have a $300,000 or $400,000 gain, ill-gotten gain. That's the amount. The actual district court fatical order said that was the amount that Rhodes got.
That's the amount that ended up in his pocket, right?
Correct.
But let's say the facts were clear that he actually was in control of the funds and participated fully in using them to cover up with other investors whose funds had already misappropriated all of that money. And so, like, he used the money for the purpose of furthering the scheme and was in control of it. It just didn't go directly into his pocket. Or he invested it somewhere and it didn't pan out. That would still be money that he was in control of, right?
That's not in dispute, Your Honor. And I agree.
Right. So,
there
so,
is
so
Second
it
Circuit.
It can't just be that whatever he profited as opposed to what he controlled and used in an improper way, that's the proper amount, right?
No, Yes, Your Honor. I fully agree. But the real issue here, and what distinguishes this case from the other summary orders that the Court just referred to, is Rhodes did not control the Bank of America account.
You're saying he didn't control these funds because Verace was the moving force, and you argued that Rhodes didn't really know what Verace was doing with the money. But the district court found otherwise, right?
Knowledge is not...
So we'd have to say the district court was wrong in that finding. That actually Rhodes did not know what Verace was doing.
I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully. I think what this Court has to do is say, because Rhodes did not control or dominate the Bank of America account, irrespective of his knowledge, that is the reason why the amount is not forfeitable.
Can you help me understand? Part of this has, I think, I'm struggling with the relationship between the Fatico hearing and the Court's findings there and the question before us. Am I right that the Fatico hearing was really on the losses for purposes of sentencing, not forfeiture? And so the question the Court was looking at is the reasonably foreseeable losses rather than the specific sort of honeycut question about who came into possession or control of how much through the course of the conspiracy. Am I misunderstanding that as the focus of the Fatico hearing?
Yes and no, Your Honor. It's complicated. The Fatico hearing was about a broad array, as the government stated, a broad array of factual issues, including Rhodes' role, his knowledge, his participation, all of these things. But in our arguments, we were focused on loss amount. Loss amount was key.
Loss amount is different from forfeitable amount.
Yes.
Okay. And so am I right that with respect to the question of whether you raised the forfeiture challenge below, the answer is more no than yes, that the Fatico hearing covered some of the same ground, but the Court was not specifically asked to make a finding as to whether your client came into possession and control of a particular amount for purposes of forfeiture.
That narrow question was not specifically before the Court.
So am I right that we're on plain error review here?
Yes, Your Honor.
And am I right that we don't actually have any district court findings that we're reviewing for plain error because the Court didn't address the specific issue? We're having to look at the record as a whole and ask ourselves whether this rises to the level of plain error based on our assessment of the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Jared Leno. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. I represent the United States in this appeal, as I did in the district court. I just want to start by addressing the last colloquy. I think this isn't just a plain error review case. This is a waiver case. There's colloquy between the judge and defense counsel. Myself, the prosecutor, had handed up a forfeiture order, said, based on conferring with the defense, that there was no dispute as to the forfeiture order. The judge then engaged in a colloquy with the defense counsel.
Well, very brief, but yeah, the defense counsel said no objection.
That's right, Judge. And so it was specifically flagged. The district court specifically flagged this forfeiture order to the defense counsel. The defense counsel said no issue, no objection, no dispute. And Judge, that's why we don't have a more fulsome record on the forfeiture facts, because the defense waived the issue.
Well, why isn't, when you say waive, I think of a voluntary and knowing waiver of a known
sure.
right. When I think of forfeiture, and now I'm talking about forfeiture in the preservation sense and not in the money sense, I think of failure to object. Why isn't this just a straight up failure to object?
I think, Judge, those are the forfeiture cases deal more with just not raising the issue more, as opposed to an affirmative, the district court allocutes someone on, do you have any issues with this? Do you want to raise an issue here?
This was raised and the answer was, I have no objection.
Right. And I think it's kind of hard to imagine what more could have been done by the government, by the court, to kind of put, one could imagine the judge saying, are you sure? Are you double sure? That sort of thing. But, I mean, obviously that's not the kind of thing that a judge should be required to do below. And so the issues were specifically raised. And the whole point of this doctrine is an issue of sandbagging. That now we have, Your Honor has asked defense counsel about, the record. There was no developed record on the issue of control or acquisition under the forfeiture doctrine, and has asked for a remand on these points. Well, there was a point in time where the district court just specifically flagged that issue and asked, essentially, do you have any issues
here?
Was
the issue of control not at all raised? In other words, at some level, factually, there were issues of signature control that were raised during the Fatico hearing. There were issues of the relationship between the two co-conspirators that were also raised, all of which at least have some bearing on the Honeycutt issue. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that these issues are kind of factually related. And
there's no overlap.
There certainly is factual overlap in the sense of both the kind of technical issue of who's a signatory on the accounts, the more functional issue of how they were used, I think would be facts that one would probably also look to for a control or acquisition analysis in the forfeiture doctrine, but they're distinct, right? And just because you have some facts that may overlap, there may be, for example, two different co-conspirator statements, and one is challenged and one is not, one may still look to some related facts about the conspiracy, but they're different statements, there's a different analysis. And so just because two separate issues that are legally distinct have some facts you might look to in common, you know, it is on the party to raise that separate distinct issue. So I think the fact that there might be some factual relationships, some similar facts that you look at doesn't bear in the waiver analysis here.
In the waiver analysis, a little bit earlier in the hearing, where you're describing the waiver, the question was, and this was again with respect to the loss amount, I recognize, rather than the forfeiture amount. The question was, any objections other than those which we put forth prior to the Fatico hearing, and the Fatico hearing itself, we have no further objections. Is that enough to preserve the forfeiture challenge?
No, Judge, it's not. Because, again, the judge specifically raised the forfeiture issue, which is a distinct inquiry, and the defense, that was when the issue should have been raised. The idea of remanding at this point for kind of a factual inquiry to
So if there had been a more substantial evidentiary hearing on the forfeiture amount, which can be done in a context, I guess, of a sort of a quasi-fatical hearing. And thereafter, the colloquy had occurred where counsel said, I have no objection to the ultimate forfeiture order. Would that have qualified as a waiver, in your view?
Judge, if there had been, I think, to preserve the issue, for not to be waiver, you have to raise that specific issue of forfeiture.
So that's what I thought you were saying. So you could have a fight, you could have a second fight, a third fight, but you've got to continue to object, in the government's view, to the ultimate order.
So, Judge, I think, because I don't want to be hyper-technical here, I think that, like, we're not, this isn't kind of a gotcha approach. I think the point is, these inquiries are different. When you're talking about, as Judge Robinson said, loss amount, those sorts of things, it's a foreseeability analysis. It's legally distinct from the issue of control or acquisition.
I'm leaning away from the hypothetical and just saying, let's say that this was a hearing about forfeiture.
Oh.
Ultimately, the question from the district court judge was, do you have any objection to the final forfeiture order? And I've just fought. I'm defense counsel. I've just, you know, had these fights. Well, no, I know that I'm going to lose. Obviously thinking that I preserved the issue given the prior dispute.
Sure, Judge. I think, obviously caveating my answer by saying those aren't the facts here, but I think in the hypothetical, I think in all likelihood we would not be raising this argument. If there was the issue of forfeiture was flagged, this issue broadly was raised, I think that's a distinct case, and obviously each case is different.
I would think you would say it depends on what he said. So if he said, well, we continue to object when we accept your ruling, then maybe there's an objection on the record. But if he says, oh, we're persuaded that we no longer object, that would be a forfeiture.
I think that's a more precise answer. That is the answer. I guess my point is, Judge, I don't want to be seen to be taking some kind of hyper-technical approach where, you know, everyone in the courtroom thinks an issue's been preserved, any reasonable person would look at it, and I'm saying, aha, there was some kind of linguistic, you know, one word wasn't spoken at some point in time, but everyone knew what they were talking about. So I'm just trying to say that I'm not trying to take a hyper-technical approach here. Here, though, I mean, the issue was specifically flagged. There was no hearing, Fatico or otherwise, on the forfeiture question. So that scenario Your Honor put forward, which would raise a closer question and very well result in us not making a waiver argument, that's not what we have before the court now.
Well, given the possibility we might proceed to consider the question, could you maybe address this idea that Rhodes did not control the Bank of America account and therefore the forfeiture order is inappropriate?
Yes, Judge, I'd like to do that. So I think it's important to step back and just start with the facts of Honeycutt to frame this issue. In Honeycutt, the issue was a store selling essentially meth precursors, an ingredient that was used to make methamphetamine. And the person against whom the forfeiture ordered issue was entered was an employee of the store that had no ownership interest, no control. It really was a small fish. Here, by contrast, just to step back again on the facts of this case, Jason Rhodes is one of two co-founders of Sentinel. He had high-ranking executive roles. The testimony at the Fatico was that they made decisions in concert. He was, Judge Stein ruled, a full and knowing member of the conspiracy, knowledgeable and a participant in all aspects, at least in terms of discussions. True, there were some aspects that were executed on by different individuals, but the finding by Judge Stein was really that this was a robust, high-ranking member of this conspiracy who was fully aware of where its tendrils led. And so this is not a Honeycutt scenario. And so there are also the points of, and Honeycutt I mean in the sense of a low-ranking individual who didn't have control, who didn't, you know, pocket substantial sums.
But Honeycutt's the thing that matters, right? If he was not low-ranking, but actually only Varaki had access to the accounts, and he took money out of the accounts and put it directly into his pocket, and Rhodes never controlled any of the misappropriated funds, then Honeycutt would still apply, right?
Well, I mean, obviously, Honeycutt, the doctrine would apply, and we'd have to go through the facts. But I think, Judge, so, I mean, 2 points.
Yeah, I understand, but I mean, it would apply the way that he wants it to apply.
Yes, Judge, and so I think 2 points here. First, on the facts here, both of the relevant accounts, one of them Rhodes had exclusive domination and control over, and the other one, he was a signatory in the account. Right? But on top of that, I think it's the issue of his role in the company, even though someone might not be, I mean, look, when a bank holds your money, it's the bank holding it and not you. The point is you have control over it functionally. And Rhodes and Varaci engage in this conspiracy together. Their desks were, they sat like 6 feet across from each other. There's extensive testimony about decision making in concert as the two principals of Sentinel. And so we do have him on both accounts. But even more significantly than that, these were two individuals, two men, who engaged as significant high-ranking partners in the same conspiracy.
That feels like it's kind of ignoring the lesson of Honeycutt, which is that there's a difference between co-conspirator liability for losses and sort of the joint and several and foreseeability and everything that you're describing and the findings that the court made, and the narrower question of possession and control, which is what's going to drive the forfeitability. So why does the level of knowledge of what's going on tell us anything about the forfeitability of the money?
Yes, and Judge, I see I'm out of time. If I could answer the court's question, though.
Of course, yes.
Okay, thank you. So they are distinct inquiries, Judge, but the point is here they dovetail. And it's not, I'm not saying that, well, just because something was foreseeable and, you know, you'd be liable as a co-conspirator and for guidelines purposes, therefore the same forfeiture amount applies. Clearly, Honeycutt says that's not the analysis. But my point is that it's not just he had foreseeability, but he had participation. The testimony at the Fatico, extensively of Mr. Varaci over the course of almost a day of testimony, was that Rhodes was making these decisions with Mr. Varaci in concert. It's not just that he knew about them in the same way that, and Honeycutt has these hypotheticals about, you know, a college drug dealer working for a, you know, some kingpin. And clearly the court is troubled by the idea of if this low-level college student is only selling like $1,000 worth of marijuana, you know, it might be foreseeable to him that the conspiracy is selling more, but he has a small piece. Here, Rhodes and Varaci, it's not just foreseeable to Rhodes, but Rhodes is a decision maker along with Varaci. He's on both.
Yeah.
Who cares? So he's a decision maker, but let's say that he had no control over these accounts. And so the funds, the misappropriated funds, were never in his control. Then wouldn't that pose a problem under Honeycutt?
If they were not in control, then yes.
Maybe we should talk about control. So is it the case that the Bank of America account was not controlled by Rhodes and Varaki could take money out of there without Rhodes ever knowing, and he did so in furtherance of the conspiracy?
So I think the testimony was from Varaci is that Varaci said they discussed these things. So I guess my point is that
the testimony was what?
That they explicitly, Varaci and Rhodes, specifically discussed how to use these funds. And so Varaci and
Rhodes. Does that qualify as control?
Well,
By the defendant here?
The way this operated, yes. Because it's not just an issue of, well, Varaci could do these things without telling Rhodes. those aren't the facts here. The facts were that Rhodes and Verace in concert decided to siphon these funds. So even if it was Verace who, first of all, they're both signatories on the operating account. That's point one.
That seems to me, you may be complicating this a little bit, and I say this with great respect. That seems to me to be the fundamental factual issue. Is he a signatory? Does the fact that he is a signatory on these qualify as control, the sort of control that Honeycutt would recognize as control for purposes of making the funds within that account or those accounts forfeitable and subject to a forfeiture order? Whether, you know, I don't know in this case whether that we need to get into all of these other issues that you're describing. I've been very focused on, is he a signatory? And is that under our case law? And I think your friend on the other side seems to suggest maybe it is. Is that under our case law enough? So Contarinas is an example of that. Or do we require more?
Sure. So, Judge, I want to make sure I answer your Honor's question directly. On the facts of this case, the fact that Rhodes is a signatory, with along with Verace on that bank account, and just actually
on the which bank account?
Sorry, yeah. So let me just kind of step back because I want to make sure I'm precise here. On the Wheaton account, Rhodes has an exclusive control over that. So I think that issue is kind of obvious and clear. And
how much money goes? How much money went through that Wheaton account?
So I think there was approximately $36 million.
And how do I know? How do I tell that based on this record?
So, Judge, there is the Brattle Group testified. An individual from the Brattle Group testified at the Fatico hearing, and they created a number of charts. They added up in one of those charts the number of redemptions submitted by Mr. Rhodes to Wheaton, and the number totaled $36 million.
So the $25 million figure comes out of money that comes from the Wheaton account.
So,
can I ask you this question?
Yeah.
Is it your position, is Rhodes being held liable for a forfeiture order for funds that did not come from the Wheaton account?
There were some funds, Judge, that went into the Bank of America operating account, and some funds were siphoned off before they went to Wheaton.
Before they went to Wheaton.
That is correct. So there are some funds. And the way that we got to the $25 million figure is, for both the Wheaton account and the Bank of America account, inflows were added up from each investor and then outflows to each investor, and those were netted, and the total was $25 million. So there were some funds. I think in terms of the colloquy we're having now, I guess the key issue for the court seems, I think, undisputed that the Wheaton account withdrawals, those were Rhodes' account. He had exclusive dominion and control over it, full stop. The closer
it's
question...
It's more than him just having control over the account, right? So if he's a signatory under the account, but somebody else could take money out of it without him knowing, and they do so, it doesn't mean that he's in control. Like, you have to be in control of misappropriated funds, right?
Sure.
The fact that you're a signatory on an account where funds rest properly wouldn't make you liable for a forfeiture when anybody misappropriates funds from that account, would it?
So the Wheaton account, he was the only one who could authorize.
Right, so that's the point, right? Is he the only one who could misappropriate funds from that account?
For Wheaton, the answer is yes.
Right.
Now, Bank of America is, I think, a closer question than the question the court is.
So more complicated.
Yes, the more complicated question. And I think, I don't mean, I think I articulated this perhaps not as clearly last time, and I just want to try again, because I do think it's a critical point here. So there is a signatory authority. Now, your honors have asked, well, is that enough on its own if it's kind of a technical signatory authority, but you don't look in the account, you don't know what's going on. That would be a close and a difficult question, but it's not the question here. And I want to be clear, what I'm about to say is not part of a foreseeability analysis, it's part of the control analysis. And the point here is, Verace was indeed, as we conceded below and we concede here, to be clear, the one who, on a day-to-day basis, functionally was the one who was really in the Bank of America account and kind of sending money here and there. That was Verace's primary role, or one of his roles was he was the Bank of America account essentially operator. Rhodes is a signatory, he could have taken money out. But two facts here. One is, he knew what Verace was doing, and they discussed this and acted in concert to execute upon it. So, yes, he might have been the tip of the spear when it comes to the Bank of America account, but they were controlling it together. Now, Verace was the one who, I guess, you go online, you click on into the webpage or whatever, you send the money out. But here, the two of them are operating in concert. A lot of these funds are being used to pay expenses for Sentinel.
So effectively, he controlled it because he could have stopped it. Is that what you're saying?
He could have stopped it, but
he's coordinating with Verace, and he knows that Verace's misappropriating the funds, and he's on the account. He could say, no, you can't take out this money. I'm going to contact the bank or something like that.
I mean, I think he could have done that, but, Judge, it's more than that. It's that he affirmatively, with Verace, made the plan and decided to have Verace take these funds out, right? So they're acting in concert. Again, not a foreseeability issue. You know, this isn't an issue of, again, the kind of the low-level marijuana dealer. They were acting together to...
Okay. So there are somewhat more complicated circumstances, factual scenarios, where the fact that someone is a signatory may not be enough and you need a little bit more, and then it bleeds into factors that, for example, we consider in connection with loss causation and foreseeability.
Right. So, I mean, one could examine a hypothetical not present here where someone is on an account and then 10 years later a fraud scheme starts and that person's not looking at bank accounts and so forth. It's really a technical matter. But here, the testimony at the Fatico, and again, this is not disputed on appeal, it's a settled issue, is that the two men really acted fully in concert. There was complete transparency between them, and more than that, they were acting together to
do
these
things. Question, if they act in concert about the conspiracy, but the agreement is to take money out of the account and put it directly into Verace's pocket, so that, you know, it goes from the corporate account into Verace's pocket, and Rhodes never has access to the funds. I mean, he's part of the conspiracy. He's a co-conspirator, but we know that that's not enough. Why should he be liable for forfeiture if the funds were always in the control of Verace?
So I think that in terms of the control of Verace, I would say that Rhodes did have control because they were acting in concert. It wasn't something where Verace was off doing his own thing unbeknownst to Rhodes. They really were hand in glove.
Right, so literally what happens is the money's in the corporate account, and then they press a button and the money is in Verace's personal account. But you're saying because they made the decision to press the button together, there's a split second or something in which Rhodes is in control of those funds?
Well, I wouldn't view it as a split second, Judge. I would assert that the entire conspiracy period when they were acting in concert, kind of, whether they kind of are, you know, both put their finger on the mouse button together, or one is doing it, I think is kind of a technicality. You know, they're operating as agents of each other. And again, not to the foreseeability analysis, but the point is what they're doing is a deeply entwined acting in concert throughout the length of the conspiracy. And again, there was an extensive Fatico hearing on this, both the cooperating witness, Verace, as well as the financial.
I'm not aware of a precedent from the Second Circuit on quite the point that I think you're making. But I might be wrong. Anyway, we've kept you well past
one, and I know you've covered this with my colleague, but I just want to be clear. I'm trying to figure out where in the record I find $25 million going through the Wheaton account. Forget about the Bank of America account. And you cited somebody's testimony. Is one of these exhibits in the appendix, does it chart that out for us, or do we have to go back to the transcript and reconstruct the testimony to get there?
There's an exhibit, Judge, and I just want to find it is in the 8,000 series, and I want to find it for Your Honor.
That's 500 or the end of the 400s and beginning of 500s?
I think that's right. And I can get Your Honor a site. I just have to kind of just peruse my materials briefly.
I'll tell you what we'll do. Unless you follow up.
So
we'll go to hear rebuttal, and then just remind me, Mr. Leno, about the page and provide us with the site.
I will. And if I can make one, this is a 10-second point, but I think it's important. We did confer in advance of argument, and there's one factual thing that I think the defense is no longer asserting.
Mm-hmm.
There's argument about $2 million being held back by Simmons and not sent to Sentinel, and the argument was, well, this never even hit the Sentinel accounts. That $2 million was actually not included in the $25 million forfeiture number, and so my understanding is that the defense is withdrawing that argument. Okay. And so that's on consent. We've conferred, and we're on the same page, I believe.
Thank you. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just do want to confirm that latter point. I alluded to before there were three methods through which Verace stole funds. The third method was he and an individual named Steven Simmons. They duped an investor named Nila Fortino out of $6 million. Simmons and Verace split $2 million of that $6 million.
only $4 million hit Bank of America. So it's complicated because the forfeiture order imposes joint and several liability on Stephen Simmons, but my colleague is correct. We are not including that $2 million amount in the forfeiture argument.
So I was very interested in your answer to Judge Robinson, where you acknowledge that we are in plain error. Now, you know, waiver is a separate issue, but you at least acknowledge that you forfeited the argument with respect to forfeiture by saying that we're in plain error territory. Is that correct?
That is what we're saying here, Judge, and I do want to address the waiver argument. There's no waiver here. I mean, the government asked, how could you envision a clear case? Well, you look at the forfeiture order, it could say on consent. It could be signed by the defendant and the defendant's counsel. It would say it is hereby stipulated and agreed. The FATICO hearing was extensive, but we did not specifically say we are objecting to control for the purposes of the forfeiture amount at the FATICO hearing. I do think that there...
So in one sense, maybe you've forfeited the argument, but okay.
But maybe. But it's definitely not waiver, and that's the crucial key here. Now, I do want to make one thing clear. I am not arguing that being a mere signatory on a bank account is sufficient to show control. I know no precedent in this circuit that would say that. Now, the government has alluded to these individuals.
What about the argument that they're making the decision together to take the money out of the account?
Yes, and that's just not supported by the record. There's one instance here.
So that is a factual dispute, right? So you would agree that if they made a joint decision to take money out of the account, regardless of whose name was on the form or on the website or whatever, they would be jointly in control of those funds?
No, Your Honor, because
so you
have... No, I don't. You have to have independent, individual control and domination of an account.
So there are two signatories on the account, and they get together and they say, let's take money out of this account and put it toward our business. Just literally, only one person's name is going to be on the form that takes the money out, right? But haven't they done everything together?
No, I don't think it shows control and domination.
So really, so the accident of whoever his name is on the form is the only person who can be liable for forfeiture of those funds?
No, it's not. It's not an accident. It's. Let me give you a concrete example here, and I think hopefully this helps. There was an incident referred to in the FATICO hearing, which the government cites extensively in support of the forfeiture order, but. This incident involved Verace going to a place called South Orange, New Jersey. He withdrew just enough cash from the Bank of America account to not trigger an alarm at Bank of America. I think it's under $10,000 or whatever it is. The government cannot seriously suggest that Verace got on the phone with Mr. Rhodes and said, hey, I'm going to withdraw these funds in South Orange, New Jersey. There's no way you can act in concert in that.
That's a factual dispute, right? So then you're saying that actually they did not make joint decisions to take the money out. And that's a separate question.
That is a separate question.
So if, in fact, Verace had gotten on the phone and said, I'm taking this money out of the bank in South Orange, New Jersey, then maybe they would be controlled. But
no, I still don't think it's enough.
All right, well, I just want to separate out these two things. So you still think it's enough. And putting that aside, you're saying the record doesn't show that they acted jointly.
Yes.
But the district court did think that they were acting jointly.
The district court thought that Rhodes knew in toto the general scheme of what was going on here. The district court did not find that Rhodes knew each and every misappropriation by Verace.
I don't know that the district court has got to do that in connection with loss causation or to the extent that this bled over, as I put it, into the forfeiture analysis to need to make those findings.
Right, but I know my time is almost up, but I just want to make the point again. We have a $400,000 ill-gotten gain here. I mean, the purpose of forfeiture is to disgorge the defendant from that ill-gotten gain.
So the problem is that once you engage in a conspiracy, right, then that expands the forfeiture landscape, and I think you agree with that.
I do.
And if Honeycutt sharpened it a little bit for us and said, but you know, you correct me if you think I'm completely off base here. I don't think I am. But Honeycutt then says, you know, each individual defendant has got to at least, you got to show, the government's got to show that that defendant had some, had acquired or had some control. Now, you use the word domination. I don't see the word domination anywhere. That's a sort of a separate analysis, but maybe I'm wrong. But I'm very focused on control, including signature control.
All right. There was a Peters case issued by this court, I believe in 2013. It was pre-Honeycutt, but it was cited by the district court decision, which we cited in reply. Mm-hmm. And that really goes through what it applies the Peters test post-Honeycutt to similar facts. In that case, you had an entity, let's call it Entity A. You had two individuals, and it talked about what the people could be responsible for forfeiture purposes. In that case, the facts were more favorable to the defendant, but that provides a good litmus test for this kind of analysis.
Thank you very much. We'll reserve decision. Oh, yes, government.
Judge, the citation, it's at page 4 of our brief, and the citation we have is to appendix 247 to 50, 499 to 500, and 504 to 510.
What was the first one, 240?
I'm sorry, 247 to 50, okay. comma, 499 to 500, comma, and then 504 to 510, and that's what we cite for that proposition. And among those cites is a table created by the Brattle Group that lists all the redemptions.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.